Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good morning and welcome to the New Books in History podcast, part of the New Books Network. My name is Christoph Odinius. I'm the host, and our guest today is Dr. David Tavares. He is a historian and linguistic anthropologist. He is professor of anthropology and director of Latin American and Latino-Latina studies at Vassar College. He is a specialist in Nahuatl and Zapotec texts, the study of Mesoamerican religions and rituals, Catholic campaigns against idolatry, indigenous intellectuals, and native Christianities. He is the author or co-author of several books and dozens of articles and chapters. This is our second discussion on the podcast, and in the first one, a month or two ago, we talked about his edited volume, Words and Worlds Turned Around, and I will add that link to the blog or the show notes below so that the listeners can hear more from Dr. Tavares. Today, we're going to talk about his first book, or his earlier book, I should say, The Invisible War, which came out in paperback in 2013. Welcome, Professor. Tell us about The Invisible War. The title is a quotation. Tell us what it means and what is the context.
Well, first of all, thank you, Christoph, for having me in your podcast again. And I'll tell you briefly what it is. I mean, it comes actually from Paul's sixth epistle to the Ephesians, in which he makes, and this is something that I think people who are familiar with Christianity and St. Paul know about. He wants people to go on a war, which is an invisible war, right? That is going to be between the faithful and the common enemy, which is, of course, the devil. So he has them, you know, put on all these different things, like the chastity belt, the coat of mail of justice, the shield of faith, the helmet of salvation, the spirit of the sword, and of course, sword is the word of God. So he decks them up as warriors in this invisible war. And I took this from a 1656 publication by the Bishop of Oaxaca, Evi Valdez, who had a kind of a star extirpator of idolaters, somebody who made it his life's mission to destroy indigenous religions in the colonial period. And this person was Gonzalo Balsalobres. So it kind of gives a really interesting perspective into the mind of the people who were trying to destroy native religions, 104 years after conquest. They must have been desperate by then. And of course, you know, this kind of rhetoric is interesting because it tells us that they see this as a kind of a war to be fought with no quarter. Right? It is divinely ordained. It comes from probably the more, what is the right word? The most militant of the New Testament writers, St. Paul. Of course, from an indigenous perspective, there's not really a war that is going on. I mean, people are just trying to get on with their lives in the colonial period. They're trying to apprehend Christianity. They still have their ancestral devotions. So it's interesting because it's, of course, both a reflection of what the church and its agents wanted to do, how they saw the conflict. And on the other hand, it is really a war that is taking place most of the time in the minds of the extirpators themselves. And of course, the last thing out of Invisible War that I like as a metaphor is that a lot of the records that I work with are actually, for the most part, poorly known, particularly some for Oaxaca, some for Toluca. So I like this idea of this spiritual warfare coming back into the open and being seen by people in the 21st century, because it was, of course, hidden, thus invisible, because a lot of these records hadn't been analyzed in detail.
And the sources that you refer to are supremely impressive. This book is no microhistory of some interesting letter you found in some archive. You spent 10 years of research in 29 archives in Mexico, Spain, the US, France, Belgium, Italy, and Vatican City, following 160 judges and 896 defendants accused of idolatry, sorcery, and superstition. So I think you, of all people, can make broad statements and tell us the contours and the shape of this really big, perhaps invisible, perhaps now more visible history. What did you learn?
I should start by saying that they didn't set out to write this book. A lot of people have told me, well, why do you put so much stuff in one book? There should have been two books. And now I think that
I thought about asking that question.
It's a little polite. This was my doctoral dissertation. I did a combined PhD in anthropology and history at the University of Chicago with Susan Schroeder, Paul Friedrich, Frederick Katz, Tom Cummins, and then at different points, other people like Marshall Salins, Bill Hanks, Terry Turner, Ray Fogelson helped me. So it's kind of a hybrid, but I guess, you know, in terms of the breadth, I set out initially, I had read the work of Richard Greenleaf, which is, of course, one of the pioneers in terms of studying the Mexican Inquisition in the 16th century in Zumárraga. And I thought, well, you know, in terms of he had an article in the Americas listing different sources, and it looked like it was like a dozen sources. So I was like, okay, I have to cover two dioceses, Mexican Oaxaca, which is where a lot of the information is, in order to get, a decent amount of documents, right? But then when I started working in the archives in Oaxaca, in Mexico, the Archive of the Indies, it became pretty clear there were all these different loose threads and also documents that people either had not worked with or had just mentioned briefly. So it became my task to put them together. And then in terms of what I learned, just to put it in periods, because I think this is one important lesson that comes out of this book. The first period, which since the time, I think, of José Toribio Medina, the great Chilean historian, has been called the Apostolic Inquisition, which is the Inquisition that exists, that is in the hands of mostly mendicants, particularly Dominicans. This lasts from the 1520s until 1571, when the Inquisition gets rid of indigenous people in terms of its jurisdiction. Indigenous people are no longer being tried for crimes against the faith by the Inquisition. Bishops have to do it. So that's the part that is better known, I think. I mean, Serge Grzinski has done a lot of work on it. From a different perspective, Solange Alberro has written kind of a long durée history of the Inquisition in New Spain. But that's the part that, in terms of indigenous so-called idolatry and superstition, was best known. And then the second period that I propose is the arrival of the secular clergy after 1571 to about the 1660s. This part, I think, was known primarily because of work of Hernando Ruiz de Larcón, the brother of the famed playwright Juan Ruiz de Larcón, who becomes an expert in Nahuatl and collects more than 60 incantations in Nahuatl in his little parish of Atenango del Río in what is now Guerrero. So it's people like him Jacinto de la Serna, who also pulls material from Ruiz de Alarcón, Pedro Ponce de León, Native Priest, Gonzalo de Balsalobre, whom I mentioned earlier, all this secular army, so to speak, who have knowledge of at least some of the indigenous languages are doing this work of investigation and extirpation in a slightly different way, of course, because they're secular. So I put them in that second period. Then there is a rebellion in what is now the Isthmus of Tehuantepec in Oaxaca in 1660. So for me, and particularly for the Diocese of Oaxaca, that seemed like a good cutting point into the or transition into the third period, because then you begin to have a number of different confrontations, right? The 1660 rebellion being one of them. It wasn't a widespread rebellion. I think Judith Seidlin has done very interesting work showing that in some ways it was kind of a PR move on the part of Spanish, claiming that the rebellion was much larger than it actually was. But it still has a lot of effects, because an alcalde mayor gets killed during the riot, and people do rise up in arms briefly. But then you have some confrontations, particularly in the northern Oaxaca, what is usually called in Spanish Sierra Norte, the northern sierras, where a lot of Zapotec speakers, northern Zapotec speakers live are alongside Ayuk or Mije speakers, and then Chinantec speakers in the province of Villa Alta. So there's a number of different small-scale confrontations, riots. The best known, of course, is the one that happens in 1700, the so-called Martyrs of Cajonas Rebellion, that this is, I'm going to talk about this maybe in greater detail later, but this rebellion and its repression opens the door for a massive campaign against idolatries that is led by Bishop Maldonado, the new incoming Bishop of Oaxaca in 1702. So this is led, roughly speaking, between 1702 and 1706. It results in the surrender of about 102 calendrical manuals with the ancient Zapotec count, which are also cosmological manuals, and then four collections of ritual songs. And again, there's nothing quite like this, I think, comparable in colonial Mesoamerica. There's certainly the Yucatec songs of Tzibalche, from the 18th century. There's all the different books of the Chilambalam, priests that have been preserved in Yucatec Maya. But in terms of just the depth and the breadth of it, and showing what indigenous intellectuals and ritual specialists can do, this is without compare, right? And then in the 1720s, after Maldonado leaves, I take that fourth and final period to be one that is characterized by more systematic attempts against indigenous people's beliefs. The establishment of Spanish language schools, the beginning of an acculturation strategy. And this lasts from the 1720s until the very end, the second decade of the 19th century, which is when the Inquisition is finally abolished, and other similar juridical procedures also stop happening, right? So it's a very different period, and I was lucky to find a cache of records in the Valley of Toluca, mostly, ranging from 1720s to about the 1770s, that gives us insight into particularly sorcery accusations, it's mostly sorcery and healing accusations in Nahuatl communities in and around the Valley of Toluca. So that's the four big periods that I have. I kind of have sketched them very quickly and briefly, but I want people to have that as a takeaway in terms of how do you take these campaigns against idolatry extirpation in both Mexico and Oaxaca, compare them, give them a particular periodization, and then talk about the outcomes and Native responses to those efforts.
Yeah, and I think it's really helpful in the way the book is organized that we can think in these categories and periods. I think we should start with the Counter-Reformation, and where did this Inquisition come from, and how did it get to the colonies of the Spanish Empire, and what did it, what was it for, what was it supposed to do?
I guess this is the part that is, I think, best known, again, from the work of Henry Lee, who started working on the Spanish Inquisition, to José Toribio Medina, to Richard Greenleaf, to other pioneers in terms of this transition. But, I mean, if I were to just kind of summarize it in terms of the roots, as I think some people might know, there is a second Inquisition that is established circa 1478 by Aragon and Castile, which are in the process of unifying the Iberian Peninsula. This is very different from the Inquisition that took place, particularly in terms of a confrontations between the heretics in the south of France that were called Cathars, right? There's an actual war with armed Cathars and armed servants of the Pope and other French rulers, roughly speaking, in the first couple of decades of the 13th century. So this is different, right? The earliest Inquisition is in some ways, depends on this kind of clash between heretics who are very militant and other people who see themselves as defenders of Christian orthodoxy and supported by the Pope. And then this one, the one that emerges in Iberia after 1478, and this, you know, we know, of course, about this from the work of Henry Kamen, who wrote a very good summary of the emergence of the Inquisition in Spain. Is different because it deals mostly with suspicions of Judaism, with this idea that all the different converts from Judaism to Christianity are actually insincere converts. And there's the suspicion that all these people in high places are actually, you know, of Jewish descent, of converso descent. So that's one of the things that, of course, the Ferdinand of Aragon and Isabella Castile are trying to determine, you know, what to do with this issue. On the other hand, as Kamen reminds us, there's a lot of Jewish people who are part conversos, former Jews conversos in their administration, so they don't want to take it too far. But this is the beginning of an Inquisition that then, when it comes into the Americas, and this is mostly through Dominicans like Domingo de Betanzos in Hispaniola, who begin to take, you know, the idea of the Inquisition is that any crime that has to do with crimes of against the Christian faith or not being a good Christian, and this actually includes not paying tithes, not giving the obligations to the church, or marrying more than once, bigamy, lots of different transgressions are prosecuted by the Inquisition. So Betanzos and other Dominicans take this to the Caribbean in the first decade of the 16th century. And then, of course, we don't really have a very established Inquisition in New Spain. We have people like the Franciscan Martin de Valencia, who's, of course, the leader of the group of 12 Franciscans who come to Mexico in 1524 on the heels of other Franciscans like Pedro de Gante and a couple of others who were already there. And Valencia actually does try and execute some noble men in Tlaxcala because he finds them recalcitrant, and they're actually plotting to stop the evangelization process. He accuses them of lots of different things, but mostly being rebellious against the Christian faith. So he has them executed. So this is not under the Inquisition's umbrella, so to speak, because there's really no formal Inquisition established. But there's people like Valencia and then Zumárraga, who is the first bishop of Mexico, who comes in the late 1520s. He doesn't really get going until the early 1530s. And then he asks the bishop of Mexico, and as also an inquisitorial judge, has the power to then bring anybody that whom he wants to bring in for questioning or for a trial in a formal Inquisition tribunal. And then this leads to the first prosecutions against Spanish, even people suspected of, heretical beliefs. And then in 1537, this is when we begin to have the first trials against indigenous people for idolatry. And it's that early period of Zumárraga is very, fruitful in the sense that you have about 19 trials for idolatry or superstition. You have a bigamy trial involving indigenous people too, that is not part of the 19 cases that I'm talking about. And this goes on from about 1537 to 1540. But then, and I guess I'll close with this observation, which takes us into like the more mature part of what happens in the first period. A cacique, the nobleman from Texcoco, Don Carlos Chichimecatehuitli, is accused of heretical propositions. He's investigated for hiding idols. They're not able to prove the second part of the charges, but he is convicted for heretical propositions, and he is actually executed in public view in September of 1539. And this brings about a transition because after a review by the Crown and other counselors associated with the Crown, they decide that Zumárraga has gone too far in terms of punishing indigenous peoples. So they remove him as inquisitorial judge. And then another set of inquisitorial judges take that place of Zumárraga eventually.
And that is a very dramatic and exciting narrative that opens your mm-hmm. book, and that the death of Don Carlos Chichimecatehuitli, mm-hmm. if I'm saying that, yes. really is, I wonder if it's representative. And I think one of the reasons I wanted to ask you about the Inquisition first, and especially because of Charles Lee, who I remember reading his mm-hmm. 1906 book on four volumes, it really mm-hmm. turned the Inquisition for Anglo-American audiences into this byword for a totalitarian mm-hmm. Kind of specter, or what Spanish historians might call the black legend, and mm-hmm. lives on in Monty Python and here and there. Yeah. But the more we read about it, the more we realize, well, it was an Inquisition, but something like 1-2% of the trials would result in execution, and yet we have it as this terrifying specter, mostly because I think it's investigating the private views of people, which is today we would, I think, all agree is inappropriate, but centuries earlier was the mandate of the authority. I wonder if you find what happened to Don Carlos here, the cacique, the exception, and I'm guessing you would say that, and I wonder what you would say that how invasive, how effective, and would the these investigations be? Can you say, having looked at all of these archives?
I mean, I think there is a consensus, if we think about the work of Solange Alberro and Harry Kamen, for instance, is that the Inquisition really had an impossible objective, right? They needed to control everyone's minds, to make sure that everyone followed orthodoxy. The way this was done is through denunciations and sometimes self-denunciations. When people realize that it's like the case of this professor at George Washington University who claimed to be African-American, turned out not to be, but then before people had a chance to say anything about her, she outed herself. So it is the same with people who self-denounce, right? So it's basically it's predicated on a fear of punishment, the enmity of people, people who might accuse neighbors or other people that they have a disagreement with of a transgression. And of course, the Inquisition had a set of rules that come from us, from the work of Tomás de Torquemada, which sets up fairly strict procedures for how you're going to conduct interrogation, the fact that you need you know, for in most cases, three different witnesses that the witnesses have to swear that they don't have anything against the accuser, that they're doing this out of their, you know, sense of responsibility and being a good Christian. So there's a lot of hoops that people have to jump through. In terms of, like you were saying, punishment, I mean, Don Carlos's execution is really unusual because, you know, I prefaced my remarks by talking about the Tlaxcalteca lords who were executed by Valencia in the 1520s. But it is... there's other punishments similar to those in Oaxaca that take place under a civil judge, actually. But, you know, besides the 1520s and these cases, a handful of cases in the 1530s, for the most part, indigenous people are not executed. In fact, I mean, most people who are convicted by the Inquisition are not executed. There's different categories in terms of how you're going to receive an absolution. The categories define what punishment you're going to receive. And the maximum punishment, which is, of course, the so-called relaxation to the secular arm, meaning the Inquisition never actually... you don't have ecclesiastics torturing or killing people. They delegate those functions to professional torturers and executioners who are working under the civil arm. When you have that determination of guilt, then a punishment is found, but the Inquisition itself does not administer the punishment. So, you know, what happens in terms of actual suffering is that, of course, there's a lot of suffering. In my cases, I found that maybe 6 to 7% of the people who are investigated are subjected to juridical torture, meaning that they use torture systematically to ask them questions to make sure that they're telling the truth. If you go through that ordeal and continue with your story, often you are regarded as telling the truth, and then the torture stops, right? So the amount of people who are actually tortured is relatively low. The amount of people executed in the end is very small. And if you think about, at least, you know, from the perspective of the cases that I've worked with, except for Maldonado's campaign in Oaxaca, you usually have about a dozen cases per decade, sometimes less. So it's not really a lot of people who are being investigated and convicted. Which brings us to the other part of the objective of the auto de fe and the public punishment and public humiliation, and this is done so people are afraid of doing what the indigenous people who were accused of idolatry and superstition did. My book has on its cover an illustration of a 1716 auto de fe, which relates to the career of Provisor de Indios y Chinos, somebody who was in charge of administering ecclesiastical justice in the Archbishopric of Mexico, Juan Ignacio Castellano y Ursúa. And you can see, you know, how they're basically, they're actually facing the judges. Their backs are towards us, and they're wearing the San Benito and the Corosa, which are the basically the shrouds where you sometimes have different drawings that depict what is it that you have been convicted of. And then the kind of dunce's cup that is called the Corosa, right? So they're being humiliated in public. I think the strategy behind it was to do some of this procedures, carry them to the very end when there were, of course, enough evidence against the accused. And part of it is like, this is a theater of punishment, right? That the idea is to impress how serious this transgression is, so that people who are watching will refrain from doing so. So it's there's a very interesting kind of economy of punishment that goes on here in terms of devoting certain resources to carrying out a relatively small number of prosecutions that are going to end up in this public theater that is supposed to serve as a deterrent for the indigenous audiences who are subject to it.
I think it's a really great cover, and I'm glad that usually on our podcast, we show the cover of the book that we are talking about. So I think all our listeners will easily be able to see this painting. How big is the painting? And the detail in it is quite rich. And I find it interesting that all of the accused are facing away from us, but we really see the faces of the people mm-hmm. watching them and taking the public lesson.
Like yeah.
A cautionary tale.
Yeah. What's on the cover is actually a selection of the actual painting.
You have the whole thing in the book. I think on page 236 in black and white.
236.
The cover is
beautiful. Is well in terms of its detail, right? It's a terrible subject matter, but what you can see, you know, when you see the entire scene is that this is actually like a public event. There's like passersby. There's a child playing with a dog on the lower right corner. So this is like definitely like a public event, in some ways a public celebration. This comes from the Museo Nacional de Arte, and it is actually a fairly large scale. I mean, I would say about, I don't have the dimensions in front of me, but it's about close to 6 feet in its largest dimensions. It's a big painting, right?
Sorry, I said it's on page 238 for our readers if they have the book, 238.
Okay. All right. Yeah. What I was going to say is that it is quite impressive also because we don't have that many representations of an actual auto de fe. We have some representations of the punishment of the Tlaxcalteca lords, they're very rare, right? So this is the one full representation we have of a colonial auto de fe involving indigenous peoples. And of course, you know, this is probably the last word in auto de fe is the famous painting from 1490s by Berruguete, which is actually in the cover of Henry Kamen's history of the Inquisition. It's of course a very different painting because of course what you have is there is Saint Dominic Santo Domingo, the founder of the Dominican Order, presiding over an auto de fe. But there's only two people, and in some ways, I mean, the both paintings have to do with rank and with placing the secular and the religious. Orders in society together, showing their rank, which is also shown in the painting that I use in my book. But in the painting, of course, that I have in my book, you have interesting details. Like, for instance, you have to the right of the viewer, to the right of the accused, convicted, are indigenous authorities who are actually carrying their staff of command. So they're there to represent kind of the Christian indigenous republic of Indians who are, of course, agreeing with the punishment on their brethren, on their fellow Indians, and who are also part of the body that is collectively punishing this indigenous people for a crime against the faith.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com. nubooks.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I would not have realized who they were. And of course, you can see the gentlemen in their wigs, and you can see the clerics in their robes.
On the left, so
wonderful. So I think we should really talk about what are these transgressions and what is idolatry. You explain how the concept of idolatry comes from ancient Hebrews and the book of Exodus with the Ten Commandments, and how it is applied. I believe you say it seems an inversion of orthodoxy, and at one point you use the term antipodal, which I love. I think it illustrates the idea, but can you say more about what is idolatry and superstition and sorcery, and does it change, and how can you find something like that out?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's I want to just kind of summarize this for our audience, but of course, in the Old Testament, idolatry is a very important transgression, and so important that people have to be punished by death, as Moses does with the followers of the golden calf. They have to actually drink the molten golden calf, thus, basically choking to death on the gold of the molten gold of the calf. There's also the ridicule of people who have given the option to worship the one true God and who don't accept it, right? That is echoed in different biblical books. Aquinas is an important part of this tradition because he's the one who begins to say, well, idolatry is actually the root of all other sins. He begins to think about, in particular, the worship of ancestors and dead people as a central issue of idolatry. And he divides into two different causes. One that is caused by humans, who miss their sons or fathers and erect them monuments to remember them. So it's kind of an emotional notion behind it. And the other one is something that is caused by the devil and the devil's intervention. So regardless of the cause, he sees idolatry as being kind of a disordered love for the ancestors, right? And this is, I think, something that is important to think about as a concept, because of course when Zumárraga and other people come in, they have perhaps Aquinas in their minds. They have other references from Habakkuk, from different biblical books. So they have a preordained sense of what idolatry is. It's basically the cult of effigies that stand in place of the cult to the one true God. And they have all these models that they draw on from classical antiquity. So in some ways, I mean, this is, and I thought this was a provocative move. I did it, to stir up some discussion. And definitely in Mexico, this has a stir up some discussion. I thought that, idolatry, a famous definition of pornography in the U.S., you know it when you see it. So in some ways, there's a particular recognition that comes in seeing what you think idolatry is and then acting upon it, right? And it's what I want to draw attention to is that usually when it comes to investigations of idolatry or sorcery, there's really not a lot of attempts. There's a few, of course, but they're
May I interrupt before you go on? I think that's a very apt comparison because clearly what is pornography, what is art? You know it when you see it. Why is that such a shocking comparison in Mexico?
Well, I mean, because people come from a very different perspective, particularly in the juridical study of a ecclesiastic jurisdiction. And they want to believe that there was some systematicity in everything that the judges did, right? And the problem here is that when you start looking for an intellectual history of idolatry in the 16th century, what you find is actually a lot of disconnects, right? And I think that sometimes for people who are just like talking about juridical concepts, they want the concepts to be permanent, systematic, squared off. And what I saw was actually not quite that, right? So Márraga doesn't really stop himself. He knows exactly what idolatry is. He knows that it involves idols. He goes straight for the jugular, so to speak, when he convicts Don Carlos of heretical propositions. He has people who are actually talking about how he is demanding that indigenous people be allowed to worship in their own ways. Because that's, you know, the Dominicans, the Franciscans, the Augustinians seem to have different ways of doing things. So let the indigenous worship as they wish. So that's heresy, right? But, you know, when it comes to idolatry, I mean, so Márraga is very clear in terms of defining, you know, what the heretical propositions are. But when it comes to defining idolatry, I think it comes down primarily to showing that people were worshiping some sort of effigy, even though neither accusers nor the people in court might necessarily know what was going on or have a sense of how it connected with their beliefs. And then there's, of course, this kind of disconnect between the 16th century, when you have people like Andrés de Olmos talking about the devil dressing up like a pre-conquest lord and inviting people to continue with their old ways. Olmos actually takes a lot of ideas from Martín de Castañeda, who's a Franciscan who writes this very important and influential treatise on different superstitions, sorcery, crimes against the faith. But then when you get to the 17th century, with Ruiz de Alarcón and Balsalobre, you find that these people haven't read Olmos because, of course, he's been left in manuscript form. There's no way they could read Olmos. These people, of course, don't know what Zumárraga did because these archives are not open up until the 19th century. These are secret archives. They have no way of knowing what other people have done in terms of finding out what, how do you talk about idolatry in a way that actually defines it before you encounter it? And how do you actually think about how the notion of what idolatry is might have moved from the 16th to the 17th century? So people like Ruiz de Alarcón and Balsalobre are pragmatists, you know. They just want to get evidence that they're praying to the old gods, that they have effigies. And they also are focusing on what it is that you need to do to actually establish a legal procedure that is going to be orthodox from the standpoint of ecclesiastical justice. So Balsalobre actually devotes a good part of his 1656 treatise on idolatry in Oaxaca to tell people how to put together this case. But of course, the irony is that Evi Valdés, the fellow who gave the name to this book, actually declares himself an inquisitor of Indians. This is in the 1640s when the Inquisition in Mexico is going through a lot of reforms, particularly at the hand of Medina Rico, who is this a official who comes in to try to figure out some important issues in terms of organization the Inquisition is going through in Mexico. And he is absolutely incensed that a bishop of Oaxaca will call himself an ordinary inquisitor or an inquisitor of the Indians. So he actually strikes down the treatise, has it confiscated, and confiscates all the different legal proceedings that Balsalobre instructed that Balsalobre led in Oaxaca precisely because they commit the great transgression of calling themselves inquisitors when they're not, right? So again, you have all these different disjunctions in terms of ranging from the definition of idolatry to really how to actually assume the powers that you need to have against idolaters and the correct title to call yourself, which this crisis, the Balsalobre and Evi Valdés crisis, kind of exemplifies as using terms of the different disjunctions that can occur as people in the ecclesiastical world try to define what idolatry is and how to prosecute it.
Well, as we probably have a little less than 15 minutes left, mm-hmm. I'd love for you to explain what you have discovered in the surviving traditions of the indigenous peoples. And we can frame it because I remember last time you explained why we don't say syncretism or hybridization, and you repeat that in this. I mean, this book was first. I'm sorry. You said this in this book first, and then you and I spoke about that. But you also referred to William Christensen's idea of local religion and how religion evolves a certain way in a certain place under certain contingencies. Maybe you can explain some of these surviving traditions, how they mixed in Oaxaca and in Mexico and in the Valley of Mexico, and maybe talk a bit about the discovery of these calendars and documents that came out in the beginning of the 18th century, and paint that picture for our listeners.
Okay. So I guess starting with the manuals and the calendars that I mentioned briefly, this is, like I said, a very unique corpus in that this is written by ritual specialists who know the 260-day count perfectly, who know how it relates to the 365-day count, who know how it actually has a correlation, which they continue to observe. It's always systematic with the first Julian and then the Gregorian Christian calendars. So they're kind of masters of time structures, but also space, because there's a very interesting cosmological theory that I mention in some of my works and also in my future works regarding this cosmological theory that comes out of Mesoamerica that links time and space. In other parts of Central Mexico, and I'm particularly thinking about this page one of this great codex, Ferrer y Mayer, which represents the law of time with the four directions and four trees, and then the day count describing two different circles around it. That's one way of seeing it. What Zapotecs do in this manual is actually tell us, well, there's actually all these 260 days are going up and down three different houses, as they call them, earth, sky, and underworld. There's nine levels above earth, nine levels below. There has been in recent years, I think, a dispute, well, not an exchange of views in terms of whether Mesoamerican peoples saw the cosmos as being flat or being having levels. There's interesting ideas about how the nine levels might have come from, Dante Alighieri's levels of underworld or something that is Christian in origin. From my perspective, what I found with this Zapotec manuals is that this has to have a pre-conquest origin. Because you were talking about time and space together coming in very close synchrony, it's really hard to imagine that they have a different system. They read Dante and say, oh, forget about this. We're going to invent the cosmos again in about 100 years before they catch us doing so in the late 17th century. There's not much time to do that. There's no evidence that they, love this kind of system that comes from Christianity, which is actually not nine levels, but 11 spheres, if you read the literature on it carefully. So there's lots of questions. And from my perspective, of course, this is of the Zapotec system is of Mesoamerican origins. And, what the manuals make us understand is a couple of things. One, of course, is that there is a diversity of theories about the cosmos. Sometimes in northern Oaxaca, there's people who disagree on the cosmos, but you're going to have different regional traditions. You know, you cannot think about this one solid, single Mesoamerican tradition about the cosmos, which would explain why some people think about the cosmos as kind of flatter in a way, rather than being organized on levels, which is another possibility in other theories. The other important part about the manuals, and this goes back, I think, to your question about contemporary practice and how it relates to 17th, 18th century practice, is that I found evidence of exchanges between ancestors and communities. The ancestors come down from the sky and give very specifically gifts of jewel strings and long-lived plants to their descendants. This is represented in stele, places like Noriega, places like Sachila, other places in central Oaxaca from the classic and post-classic periods. And this comes from the work of archaeologist and epigrapher Javier Urcid. So we know about these rituals. And what happens in the 17th century is that people, when they're singing these ritual songs, which are part of the corpus that I study, they actually talk about these visions of ancestors coming down from the sky with jewels and broadleaf plants, ancestors in the guise of turtles who come down as ancestor sacrificers holding flint knives, which is, of course, another element that occurs iconographically in other places in ancient Oaxaca, ancient Zapotec iconography. So you have that continuity, right, in terms of at least remembering these important rituals. You have continuity in terms of thinking about ancestral bundles, which are the so-called kikiyaktao, kind of the heads of the great tree. And these are sacred bundles that actually contain, hanks of hair, different relics from the bodies of grandfathers, great-grandfathers, which are worshipped. This is part of a very complex ancestor worship complex. Now, this definitely, the system of ancestor worship, which has a lot of political ramifications as you begin to think what it is like to worship somebody's great-grandfather in a particular community, it has disappeared. What you have right now, and I know this from, doing ethnographic research in northern Oaxaca, is that you have some of the same sacred places that people worshipped at in the 17th century are still there. And they actually, people use them to pray to what they call the people of the mountains, the people of the rivers, Beneya, Beneyegu. They don't talk about them in terms of individuals. I mean, sometimes they talk about this feather snake called Balashila. They talk about certain supernatural sacred beings, but it's not as, what is the right word? The kind of worship that occurs today is kind of informed by the history of ancestral worship, but it is not about ancestral worship, as it is more about giving the right gifts at the right time for the sacred forces that are still in charge of these places that are usually mountaintops, are usually small ponds or lakes where people still practice animal sacrifice, still say prayers to this important beings of the mountains and the rivers. So there's some elements, particularly.
I'm reminded of a Guatemalan movie from the last decade called Ishkanul, set on a volcano, where the mother and daughter, they pray, with candles to the Virgin Mary and the Father, Son, Holy Spirit. But then they also go up to the volcano with gifts of food and other things like that, and offer their homage and obeisance to the elements, the various elements, the earth, the sky, and the volcano itself. And that, I think, is probably going on in Guatemala today, just as probably happens in Oaxaca and other places. Have you seen this movie?
Yeah. No, it's a good example of that. I mean, not now in terms of, you asked about what is happening today. You can definitely talk about different communities, right? Tlapanecs, Huastecs, Nahua speakers in the Huastec region, people in Oaxaca, people in Chiapas, they speak several different Maya languages, people in Guatemala you spoke of, where you definitely have this kind of, multi-sided worship protocols. You go to particular sacred sites, they continue to be attached to a particular community. Anybody can go there, but they have a particular historical relation to a certain community, and they, in some ways, represent the sacred beings that have guarded the community from their perspective from time immemorial. So that's kind of, if you were to just do a thumbnail sketch of the kind of protocols that take place, I mean, you could put a lot of contemporary Mesoamerican worship in that in that quarter. But then, you know, in terms of what happens and how it articulates with other a ways of life, this is, you know, where it gets very interesting, because of course, you know, in terms of the what happens in the Zapata communities that I work with is you have older sites and they have newer sites that are coming into being and being regarded as powerful sites. So people go and pray to them. You still have people offer cacao beans, like in the 17th century, instead of a offering this drink that was probably something like pulque, like a maguey beverage with the root put in, so it was you know, more potent. You have people drinking Tres Coronas sherry, which is a commercially available sherry, instead of lime-cured tobacco, which was called queza in Zapotec and pisillet in Nahuatl. You have cigarettes, right? So you have this logical substitution in terms of all the different offerings that kind of have brought all these sacred gifts into the 21st century. And they still sacrifice turkeys. But something that's really important is that now you have the transnational Zapata communities that come from, as they call it themselves, Oaxaca, California, the California-based communities of diasporic Zapotecs that go back to these sites and pray. You know, I have seen people who are actually, you know, Anglo-American, who have married a Zapotec girl. They come back and they participate in a series of offerings that is meant to give them well-being as a couple, that is led by an elder person who knows some of the prayers in a Zapotec village. There is a ritual specialist that I've had the honor to know and work with, Aurelia Cano, who showed me this particular ritual that takes place at what seems to be the same place that was involved in ancestor worship back in 1704 in the town of La Chichiar, La Chiriot. So what she does is actually, she asks migrants to take a piece of clothing off their bodies, and then she says some words to the people who live in that particular sacred cave. It's a small cave called Yabe. She believes that by showing the piece of clothing to the sacred beings who live there, the migrant who's going to put those clothes back on is going to be protected by them as he or she goes back across a very perilous trip across Mexico and then across the U.S.-Mexico border. So you have, of course, a lot of different ways in which the last one that I'll mention briefly, because I know we're running out of time, is that the manuals are no longer used. The 260-day calendar is no longer used in the Northern Sierra, at least by most people. There's people in Southern Zapotec communities that still use a count of 9 days that has different subdivisions, that is has the same roots as the 260-day count, but is structurally different. That is done in some Southern Zapotec communities. But in the Northern Zapotec communities that I work with, people use this almanac, this agrarian almanac called the Manual of the Most Ancient Galvan, which is an almanac for all the different days of the year that is published every year, and it has been published without interruption since the 1820s in Mexico. So it's a very European way of thinking about time, but the way in which time is understood, particularly for offering prayers and gifts to the people of the mountains, people of the river, this has to do with a particular kind of local religion that has taken root in those communities. And I think this is where it would be helpful to, you mentioned William Christian, who has described what looked like superstition from an Orthodox Spanish viewpoint. I think it's also important to think about relations of power and who the ritual is for, because once you start building a big category that's called local religion, it can hold a lot of different things that are not necessarily the same together. Just because, you know, a particular community has a certain set of beliefs that look quote-unquote superstitious or non-modern from our perspective. That doesn't mean that they're similar. There's going to be a lot of differences in terms of relations of power, in terms of, again, transnational phenomena like the one I'm describing, in terms of substitution of offerings, in terms of integration with Christianity. And so we have to, just like with syncretism, hybridity, I think be careful in terms of really doing justice to the very different performances and behaviors that might fall under a single rubric like local religion.
I think that's a perfect place to stop and a good last word. And thank you very much for bringing us to the present and for your time today, and especially for this book, which is not long. It's 280 pages, but it opens a door to a fascinating and enormous world. And it's quite an achievement. So congratulations again, and thank you so much.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Christoph, for letting me share this words about the book. It's getting a bit old, frankly. It was published in 2011, paperback 2013 with Stanford University Press. There's more works on the way, so we will continue to learn about this manuals, traditions, and religious practices in colonial Mesoamerica for years to come, I hope.
And perhaps we can talk again when you write the next one.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it, Christoph. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.